Four shots ring out and echo through the valley of Poor Man's Gulch outside of Leeds, South Dakota. Father Belknap lies bleeding on the ground. He's been shot at point-blank range with four 45 caliber rounds. Here on the ground, he will bleed to death in his priestly vestments that he'd quickly put on, having been lured to this spot by being told a member of his flock desperately needed last rites. The brutality of this crime will shock both Catholics and Protestants across South Dakota. The year is 1921, and Father Belknap's killers will never be found. The rise and fall of the Ku Klux Klan in South Dakota is next. The Sioux Empire. We live here, but what do we really know about this land we call home? Many of us were born here writing our story. Many are new here, with new parts of the story to tell. And some of us were always here, but their stories, while not always told, have never been forgotten. This is the Sioux Empire Podcast. Stories about the Sioux Empire you've never heard in the Sioux Empire. Before we get started this month, a little business. I just wanted to say that if you're looking for something to laugh about after this very serious topic, you should check out my friend Dan Bubbitz Jr.'s podcast, The Art of Bombing. Traveling comedians share their stories about their most embarrassing onstage moments and what they learned from them. It's a fascinating and hilarious look behind the microphone of working comedians. That's The Art of Bombing, available on all major podcast platforms. And a special thanks to John E. and Leah S. for your donations to the new Sioux Empire podcast. My sincerest thanks for your donations that help make this show possible. Donations are accepted through Venmo and Patreon. More details at the end of the show. Thank you. Before we dive in, here are a few background notes to be aware of. First, the history of the many organizations that have called themselves the Ku Klux Klan over the years is large and complex and highly charged, obviously. This episode should under no circumstances be taken as an exhaustive history of the topic. Today I'm telling you the story of the Klan as it existed in South Dakota, in a state that, despite having South in its name, was not in fact part of the Confederacy. However, even its South Dakota history is quite extensive. This is a flyover version of the KKK in South Dakota. This overview and outline can be followed up with your own research if you choose. And now to establish just a little more background.
My knapsack on my back, my rifle on my shoulder. I'll march away to the firing line, kill that Yankee soldier. I'll kill that Yankee soldier. I'll march away to the firing line and kill that Yankee soldier.
Our story begins in the mid to late 1860s. The southern United States, the former Confederacy, lies largely in ruins economically, culturally, and in many cases, literally. When the smoke, cannon fire settled, the average citizens of the region found their lives turned upside down. There was no victorious welcome home for the veterans who'd suffered ridiculously grotesque deprivations during the war, only to lose everything all over again when returning home. The industrial scale of warfare that at the time was pioneering left a landscape of burned cities and infrastructure not so different from the wastelands that would become familiar to Europe after the world wars in many places. The usual thing historically when you have large groups of unorganized and impoverished young men is trouble. They became organized to wreak havoc by pushing their own feelings of injustice and their own political and cultural views. In this case, they organized into secret societies with names like Pale Faces and the White Brotherhood. In Tennessee in 1865, six young men decided to form a club. The name they chose was based on the Greek for the circle, Kluklos. Combining this with some good old-fashioned American mispronunciation gave birth to the name of the organization that we recognize today, the Ku Klux Klan. In April of 1867, a collection of former Confederate soldiers, officers, and politicians met in Nashville, Tennessee, to give this growing band of brutes direction. Former Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest was chosen as the first Grand Imperial Wizard, the man Forrest Gump was famously named for.
Now, when I was a baby, Mama named me after the great Civil War hero, General Nathan Bedford Forrest. She said we was related to him in some way, and what he did was, he started up this club called the Ku Klux Klan. They'd all dress up in their robes and their bed sheets and act like a bunch of ghosts or spooks or something. They'd even put bed sheets on their horses and ride around. And anyway, that's how I got my name, Forrest Gump.
The Klan, which had started as a juvenile kind of social club to entertain themselves by terrorizing black people, gradually escalated from mostly psychological terror to physical violence and terrorism. Despite having a newly appointed leader, the organization was extremely decentralized, and rogue elements acted beyond the control of the fledgling leadership. Explosive growth combined with poor planning and weak central authority meant that the group became more brutal, more unstable, and more savage as its numbers continued to grow. By January of 1869, Imperial Wizard Forrest ordered the dissolution of the order. His reasoning was that the Klan had become perverted in some localities, which is saying something, and that public opinion was turning against the Klan. Apparently, it's hard for terrorists to win a popularity contest. Who knew? However, the Klan survived as small splinter fringe groups in the Deep South through the 1870s, the 1880s, and the 1890s. The Klan that eventually emerged was the one that spread to South Dakota, becoming a radically different organization from the one that had started in the 1860s. The Klan of the 20th century was created through the growing income inequality in the rapidly industrialized Gilded Age. Economically hard times for many Americans, and industrialization brought a cold brutality to daily life that many Americans had never experienced before. There was tremendous frustration throughout society, and the Gilded Age provided a scapegoat for their frustrations in the form of cheap immigrant labor. Immigrants from the West, from China, were brought in to build the railroads, the train tunnels, and to work the mines. Chinese workers helped build and run the mines in Deadwood, and their incredible stories are too much to tell here, and will be featured in their own future episode on this podcast. I've been fascinated by their story since I was 12 and I visited the famous Boot Hill Cemetery in Deadwood. My curiosity couldn't help but notice so many grave markers with Chinese characters. Non-Anglo-European immigrants in the industrial East came from countries like Ireland, Italy, and Greece, and many other Mediterranean countries. Today, we would consider this group of people white. Important to note that nativist, or European Americans born in the United States, and not to be confused with Native Americans or the indigenous people who were already here, up to this point were a relatively homogenous group of Anglo-Europeans with a Protestant background. That strict definition was what Americans of the time considered to be, quote, white. There is a book on this topic that I would highly recommend to aid your understanding of how the definition of whom Americans called white has shifted dramatically over time. The History of White People is a book by Nell Irvin Painter. To give you the short version, these new immigrants were not considered true whites by the nativists. Many of the new arrivals were Catholic, especially the Irish and Italian immigrants, and there was also a large wave of Jewish migration with these new immigrants. These people carried ideologies from Europe that were strange to Americans, like socialism, communism, and anarchism. This difference of religion and culture combined with the perception that immigrants were scabs, who were only here to drive down wages at a time of economic upheaval. This disparity set nativists on a collision course with these new Americans, and waiting in the wings to absorb these frustrations was a semi-dormant Klan. In 1901, one of the first catalyst events that pushed nativism mainstream occurred when President William McKinley was shot by a self-professed anarchist who spoke with a foreign accent. This exploded the nativist sentiment, and a slowly regrowing Klan benefited by latching onto this movement. However, it would take a blockbuster event to marry nativism with this new Klan. At this point, the first traces of the reborn and rebranded Klan are starting to show up in South Dakota's historical record. A grand masquerade ball was held at the Miners Union Hall in Central City. It hosts a string orchestra from Billings, Montana, and an oyster bar. Admission is $1. The event is organized by the Ku Klux Klan, and that name is displayed proudly in their 1902 ad in the Deadwood Pioneer Times. That same year, the final catalyst to joining nativism with the new Klan would begin with Thomas Dixon Jr. Dixon published his books, The Leopard Spots in 1902, and a sequel, The Klansman, a historical romance of the Ku Klux Klan, in 1905. They were hailed as a literary success and were considered, forgive me for the metaphor, the Harry Potter books of their time. Dixon drew on his own Carolinian experiences and told how the Carolinas had, quote, twice been saved from black degradation. So part of why I use the Harry Potter metaphor is the part that logically comes next. It's a trope now, but back in 1905, the pipeline between popular books and blockbuster movies was literally being invented, largely by the film we're about to talk about.
Okay, and I'm Shelby Hagerton. I'm a student at Wayne State College. I'm a historian. My study typically focuses on more women's health, particularly during the 19th century. I just worked on my thesis film with Sigmund Freud on his case of Dora, so it'll be Sigmund and Dora coming out. And I'm also a filmmaker. I produce, write, direct. I worked closely with Mike White on his feature film, Beaver de Nouveau, right now, so he can discuss more about that.
I'm Dr. Michael White. I'm actually the head of the film program at Wayne State College in Wayne, Nebraska. Our film school is called the Hot Attic Film School. I actually teach cinema production and theory, primarily, as well as other courses in media production. Also a filmmaker. I've made two feature films and a short film recently. For many years, I was a commercial producer. I guess I'm also a bit of a cinephile as well.
The film we're talking about is Birth of a Nation.
Why don't I give a little bit of a personal thing as well? My grandfather is French, or was French. He's long since passed. And he was a restaurateur in Lorenz, Iowa, and the Klan ran him out of Lorenz because he was a French Catholic. They burned a cross in his yard and ran the family out, which kind of financially devastated my mother's family for a period of years. I have kind of strong feelings a little bit about the Klan as well, because I have a little bit of a personal stake in it, you know, from my family's history.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, I don't know. I do teach Birth of a Nation in class, but I do not show it.
The history standpoint, I mean, I've never had to watch it, obviously, in any film courses. I've only heard about it, talked about it. But in history, I have had to do quite a bit of analysis on the film, the cultural relevance. So, I have watched the film because of my history degree, my history background. So, it's interesting to think that we don't watch this film in, you know, film courses and film studies, especially because it is, you know,
here,
other areas they do, but it was more of a study in history. But we were having a discussion earlier too about how Mike might show a part of a propaganda film, like from the Nazis, because it's more of something that they can learn from as a propaganda standpoint. But that is something that we don't watch over in history. Yes, so it's kind of the opposite.
And I think, too, one of the it's very difficult when we take a look at Griffith, though, too, because if you look at the really important films that were made at the beginning of cinema, Birth of a Nation, as a feature, as an American feature, is probably one of the absolute most relevant films.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult for me to swallow that for a variety of reasons. Why is this? Well, one, it has extraordinary technical innovation in it. Griffith, whether we like the content or not, was a good filmmaker. People don't realize it, but he was very famous for what we call one-reelers. And if you don't know what a one-reeler is, today we would call it a short film, but back then, you could only fit 20 minutes on a typical cinema roll film, so we call that a one-reeler. He has fantastic one-reelers, and there are a lot of people that say, well, there's no reason to show Birth of a Nation when we can study the one-reelers, which were made by Griffith. However, none of those really have the technical innovation that Birth of a Nation does. Mm-hmm. For example, it's basically a three-hour-long film, which was very, very rare. Secondly, too, it was done in some of the first colorization. Back then, it was called Kinem Color, mm-hmm. and it kind of used commercially from about 1908 to about 1915. And it was kind of invented, it was kind of a form of tinting. Georges Méliès, if you're familiar who that is, he was a French filmmaker, did also film tinting by hand, but this was a little bit more of a different process. So it was kind of a two-color created with additive. But that's why when you see Birth of a Nation, you have these colored, you know, pieces of the film throughout it. It took 18,000 people to make Birth of a Nation. Jeez. So by any modern standard, there's nothing like that. I mean, it's basically an impossibility. There were 3,000 horses used, you know, in it. It had tons of technical innovation: flashbacks, cross-cutting, dissolves, close-up, panoramic filming, as well as the color theme you talked about earlier. There were no films that were really like that, especially made in the United States. You know, you talk about in France, of course, they were making films, but not really at this scale. This was an expensive film to make back then. So, I mean, from a standpoint of spectacle, technologically, it's really, really innovative, which kind of puts me, especially as a professor, in this awkward position where you're now looking at, you know, views, very racist views that, you know, kind of, you know, I mean, I'm going to sound probably strong-handed here, borderline almost fascist, you know, in this film. So do we show this technically innovative film and say, well, ignore the social context of the film?
Because, you know, part of the reason that, you know, the spectacle, I mean, when you're talking about the spectacle, that's what really led to such an increase in the number of members of the Ku Klux Klan, because, I mean, you have these grand, you know, you see all these horses riding in, you see all the Klan members coming in to save the day, to rescue the woman, and there is a giant spectacle of a show, so it makes these Ku Klux Klan members, these people willing to kill others, into heroes, and that's a part of the spectacle because it was on a level that we'd never seen before in film.
Yeah, and I think too, we think about the Star Wars movie or the height of an Avengers movie. Mm-hmm. This was absolutely as large or larger.
Yeah.
You know, and that brings us to something else that Griffith was very famous for. He was really the first person internationally to have fantastic marketing and public relations to push him a film. Nobody had that before that. So he was really more of a genius from the standpoint of marketing and promotion. And it really created this giant media spectacle that impacted the whole country.
Well, yeah, and you know, certainly because if you, looking back before the screenings, before the premieres, they would have giant parades where everybody would wear their white sheets and ride horses, shoot rifles into the air. And it got to be so popular that even ushers would wear white sheets when they were bringing people to their seats in the theaters. It was a grand spectacle, and it was fun, and it was live.
It's very interesting, too, because the NAACP, and Shelby can probably cement on this, I believe had resistance toward the film at this time. And you have to excuse me, I'm really more of a technician, you know, from the standpoint of analysis. But
well, the NAACP ran several protests against it that were unsuccessful, and you know, this is the first film, American film, ever shown in the White House. And, you know, we can say whatever we want that Woodrow Wilson didn't know what it was, but he knew. He was friends with the writer. He was friends with the playwright. And the fact that he still continued to show this, despite the number of letters that were coming in, I mean, it just shows the culture of the time and the change, because, I mean, the NAACP was protesting against it at nearly every point, but it just kept rising in more popularity because that was the leadership at the time as well. It's not that, you know, I mean, Wilson was more racist. I mean, there's enough evidence to say that he was more racist than other people at the time, because people were asking him to not segregate the government, to not show this, but white people were. And prior to him, I mean, we had Teddy Roosevelt and Taft. They had both appointed black statesmen to official positions within the government. But Woodrow Wilson was also the first Southern president since Lincoln.
Yeah.
And he's also the only person in this film that is quoted by name.
One of the things, and I don't want to get too off topic, though, but if we take a look at African-American film, I mean, from that standpoint, you really study has to begin with this film because it prevented parody. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say prevented parody, but it delayed parody in film for a very, very long time. Even if you look at black exploitation films of the 1970s, mm-hmm. you know, we are just now we are just now, I would say, you know, probably beginning with Spike Lee, we are just now starting to see black filmmakers start to have the voice they really deserve.
Yeah.
And I think, and personally, I think, looking at this from a historical perspective in cinema, this film really was kind of a, you know, like a ball and chain for black cinema. People don't realize that there was someone with the NAACP, and I cannot remember who it was. It was a black director, created an opposing a film, kind of rebutting.
Within Our Gates.
Yeah, within our, that's right, Within Our Gates. Rebutting this film, or, you know, go ahead and rebutting Birth of a Nation. And that was really something that kind of launched African American filmmaking. And that voice, and just now we're starting to see fantastic voices in black cinema in the United States, but it just took so long, mm-hmm. you know, it especially if you take a look at, you know, the voice, like in Europe, minority voices in Europe started to speak in film much earlier than the United States.
And even if you look at black actors, I mean, so many times, even today though, you know, white characters are portraying black individuals, where, you know, if you look at, you know, let's say the World Trade Center in 2006, Sergeant Marine Thomas was originally black, but one of the men who portrayed him was white. I mean, you have strong black characters that are being portrayed as white people in film, and it's a real shame to not have those people represented the way that they should.
Not too terribly long after, you know, when Gone with the Wind came, mm-hmm. you know, you had the fantastic actress, there, who she played the midwife.
Yeah, and right. She was the first black actress to win an Oscar.
Yeah, and she was treated so shabbily at the Oscar celebration. It was just, you know, it's shameful now, and I think,
for sure.
You know, it's too bad the Academy has never really had the ability, or maybe they shouldn't probably kind of apologize for the poor treatment of that woman. But I mean, it sets us back.
I want to say it was Spike Lee actually talking about Birth of a Nation, because you'll see him in interviews talk about that film's influence once in a while. What do you think of the interpretation that D.W. Griffith doesn't see racism as America's original sin so much as race mixing?
Yes, I would agree. That's something that, if you look at that second wave of the KKK, it's pretty much focused on interracial relationships. Because there was a great fear, and you see that in the film too. I mean, the main issue is black men with white women. And it's still an issue where people talk about it today, where it's the protection of the white woman who can't decide for herself who she's going to be with, and that black men are rapists. And there's that whole focus within the film, and it's very dangerous. But it's something that we definitely see today, and definitely a common analysis.
Well, if we look at some of the documentaries, the fantastic documentary Age of Rage,
Age of Rage on Netflix,
which is about the new rebirth of white supremacy in the United States. Also, the fantastic film about Charlottesville that was actually created by HBO, created that documentary. It's fantastic. But when you take a look at those, that is still, in white supremacy, the big underlying theme, the idea of race mixing is still, and we are seeing, at least the Southern Poverty Law Center, they warned four or five years ago that white supremacy was on the rise, and they were right. I mean, we are actually, I never thought I would see like Charlottesville in my lifetime, but it is, it's very real.
I mean, there's even an interview in the alt-right Age documentary where they talk about white women and that they need to be saved to remain pure, and that there should be no mix. And that's still the common theme today that we're still hearing in these documentaries.
Isn't it strange, though, that we see this film that was made so long ago, that this subversive social content still exists?
Yeah.
I think one of the things that's important to mention is, and this is, this, especially in my family, you know, coming from, you know, my grandfather's first language was French, not English. He's a professional chef. He owned restaurants. He was a successful restaurateur, living Midwest in Iowa.
Yeah.
And I think one of the important things is that they were anti-immigrant.
Yeah.
They were very anti-immigrant. They were very anti-Catholic. So the persecution which took place in my family really was more about immigration than immigration and Catholicism, as opposed to being black. So I think people often forget, you know, we have these parallels that we see today, and we may say, okay, well, yes, it was about black people, but have we really changed that much? I mean, we still are blocked the borders, you know, resisting minorities. What happened to my family is very similar to what happens to other families in another continent today. So, you know.
It's just, there might not be this organized Ku Klux Klan in all areas, but there are organized white supremacist groups that have been more fragmented that still focus on the purity of a white woman or anti-immigration or anti-various religions.
They just have different
names. They just have different names.
Yep.
That's all the differences.
Do you think that D.W. Griffith's follow-up film, Intolerance, if you're familiar with that film at all, is an apology for Birth of a Nation?
I don't think so at all. To be really honest, I think it's more of a tracking of different cultures that have, you know, quote, fell because of various problems that they had to deal with. And those problems that he would be speaking about now would be the black population and the issue and the worry that they might rise up and take over the white person.
Yeah, and I think one of the things with Griffiths is that he was very, very smart. And he was... The one thing that eclipses his skills as a filmmaker is really his skill as a publicist, a self-publicist, and being able to stay in the good graces of the public without necessarily making an apology was really kind of his skill. So I would say that's probably the, you know, part of the case.
More of a, I'm going to misdirect my audience as I'm still sort of giving my views on how I think the world is and what's going to be happening, but in a more historical context and in a way that won't necessarily incite violence or upset anybody.
Do you have anything else that you'd like to say about this film and its legacy?
This is maybe not so much about the film and its legacy, but it is really more from the standpoint as an educator. Shelby's planning to become a film theorist. She's going off to study film theory in a master's and PhD program. I teach film criticism and those types of things. But this is a very difficult thing, because if you take a look at other film schools, it is very common that this is taught. It's taught for a variety of reasons, because you can learn a lot from the film. But the question, I think one of the things that's difficult for me is this a film that we show for its technical expertise, or is it something we show as a cautionary tale? Is this a way that we can show a film and say, listen, these are some of the possible social ramifications and effects of a film like this? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it warrants watching this film so we can learn what not to do, or let's watch this film for technical reasons, because it does bring up a lot of ethical dilemmas. And I think if you brought in 50 different film professors, they would have 50 different perspectives on what that is. And I think it's why the film is so commonly shown in film schools. And I would say it is shown in most film schools in the country for that reason. And I don't know. It's such a difficult question.
I mean, in 1992, the Library of Congress said the film was, quote, culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant, which, despite what else is in the film, it is culturally significant. I mean, it had a very big impact on America. It shaped a lot of America that we see today.
And shaped a lot of American cinema.
Yes.
A lot of American cinema a lot of American cinema structure, design, editing, cinematography, much of that is emulated by this film. So by taking it out of instruction, it's kind of like, you know, it's such a difficult thing. We run into this all the time, though. I mean, we have this with Harvey Weinstein. Do we no longer teach anything Harvey Weinstein had a hand in? Do we no longer teach anything Woody Allen had a hand in? when you take those two people out, you're taking out most or many of the greatest films created in the last 30 to 50 years.
I mean, as a historian, I don't believe in the removal of history, and this is history. But there's ways to show the film, discuss the film, that also doesn't glorify the film. You know, don't put it up on a pedestal. Don't say that it's perfect. But use it as an instructional tool to say, yes, this was sort of the first editing technique, the sort of first framing technique that we base modern film off of. But maybe we should discuss the context in a little bit different light, and also perhaps show some other films that might show these similar techniques that came later, as opposed to showing scenes from this film.
I don't know. I mean, I think, very fortunately, I do not teach a film history course. but I do teach I do talk about the film in Intro to Mass Communication and also Mass Media and Society, in which we talk about the social ramifications and effects of film. And, I don't know. I mean, I really wish I still had family members who were alive at the time that this film came out, especially to see what it was like for my very frightened family at the time. So I'm not sure.
You know, this is the same dialogue that historians are having all across America right now with the statues. It's really no different. You know, how do we take a piece of art that was made and created, and how do we look at it? Because, I mean, it is, you know, there is a terrifying history that's linked to it. But what do we do with this art now in a more modern context?
You know what's funny is when we look at Germany. And Germany is very different because, of course, they had fascism and, of course, the ethnic cleansing of Jews. If you look at that, I think one of the most interesting things is if you go back and you look at Metropolis, the fantastic film by Fritz Lang, it's a cautionary tale about fascism.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
It's so funny that they have this cautionary tale about fascism, and then fascism takes over, rises and takes over. And in the United States, I think what's very different about us, especially when you take a look at Germany, Germany is very apologetic about that. But for some reason, we don't have this very apologetic stance about slavery, especially in cinema.
Americans would rather forget than apologize.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
So I would agree with that. And looking at it from an educator's standpoint, too, I mean, I'm not quite there yet, but looking at it, I mean, if you think about like high school courses, the way that American history is taught, we don't teach past the Second World War. So we miss the Civil Rights Movement completely. And when we teach the Civil War, we learn about Lincoln and we put him on a nice, beautiful pedestal.
Yep.
And that's about all that we think about. We don't think about the, you know, murder of slaves. We don't talk about the systemic oppression of blacks. We don't talk about that because that's not what we want to think about. We want to think about Lincoln, and we want to think about the great saviors, the great white saviors that came in to save all of the black people. You know, that's how we teach it in high schools and middle schools and elementary schools. So there's a change that needs to happen within the education system as well as how we talk about this. The dialogue needs to shift in order for there to be a major change.
I don't know. I mean, I think part of it is living in what they would call the North. I think it is different because when I go down south and I see statues of Confederate generals, I often think of it the way you think of Hitler or Mussolini as a statue in a public place. You know, if you look at Germany, you know, there are no statues of Hitler.
I mean,
there are no statues of Mussolini on the street. It is very interesting that we glorify this. It is interesting to me.
The bunker that Hitler killed himself in is a parking lot now. Yeah. You know, nobody sat there and said, we need to make this a historical landmark. They put a parking lot on top of it because we feel the need to sit there and glorify it or make a place for somebody like that. And, you know, that's something that we could have seen more during the Reconstruction era, and that probably something would have continued. But with the election of Woodrow Wilson and with the making of this film, that was something that ended quite suddenly and quite unexpectedly, especially when you had presidents prior that were all for, you know, being black statesmen and, you know, enforcing more of a equal rule, basically. You know, it's shocking to see how suddenly something like that can turn, because, I mean, the Reconstruction era was doing fairly well until that election. So it is very scary and very interesting to see exactly how quickly that can turn with one election, with one film, with just one ideology moving up in the ranks.
From the standpoint of media effect, mm-hmm. there are a lot of theories that discuss media effect, and one of them is that media does not necessarily have a large effect on people.
Yeah.
It can reinforce your ideas. So, for example, the huge popularity of polarized media such as MSNBC or Fox yeah. News is because people watch those channels because they reflect ideas that they already have, and reinforce beliefs they already have, even sometimes falsely. Mm-hmm. So one of those things is when this film came, people already felt this way. It was a mass confirmation of the feelings that the general public had, and they latched onto it and said, wow, yes, I feel this way. You see, I was right with how I feel, and this is affirmation about how I feel.
Yeah.
So when we have this, it is a cumulative effect. Your friend neighbors believe something, you watch a film that believes that, and then it does this. So one of the things I think, and we can learn from this in media today, is by having a lot of voices in media, minority voices and women's voices in media, we're constantly talking about the lack of women's voices as writers, directors, and filmmakers. Having those voices are what allow us to have more parity, I think, in film.
You know, you're not supposed to do what-ifs in history, but I think it'd be interesting. If this film wouldn't have been made, I think another one would have been. I think, it was a matter of time, because, I mean, if you're thinking about the way media works and that these feelings were already instilled in people, there was going to be a director that was going to make a film similar to this, because the passions were already there. And with a president that supports that the segregation of people, there was already a passion for learning.
Shelby, that is extremely depressing and probably true.
Yeah.
Well, film from the standpoint of economics, mm-hmm. okay? What sells and what is a surefire bet? That has never changed in cinema.
Systematic oppression.
Yes, that has never changed in cinema. So if you say, okay, what kind of film can we make that the public will love and will go to and support? Yeah. If you can create a film that does that, in this case, a film about racial hatred.
Yeah.
You create a film, well, people will go to this film and spend money. And Griffith made a lot of this film made, I mean, if you look at it by today's numbers, it made extraordinary amounts of money. I mean, on the blockbuster levels mm-hmm. or greater than today. And also enough to fund his sequels. This film made him quite rich, much, much more than the little one-reelers that he was doing before for small movie pieces. So, I don't know.
And, I mean, you can see that this continued because of Blackface continued. I mean, it didn't just stop with this film. They knew it sold. I mean, you see that in The Jazz Singer. You see it in Swing Time. You see it in hundreds of movies.
Yes.
It's just is a recurring theme because it sells. Because people liked it. They thought it was funny. They thought it was fun. They would rather see their favorite white actor doing blackface, doing something serious or, you know, really pulling deep to bring that character out, than they'd rather see a black character doing it.
Oh, yeah. They, you know, and that kind of goes with what you were saying about either way this would have happened.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that the whole idea of the blackface performance, I think that got its start in even earlier in minstrelsy shows and like vaudeville, didn't it? It was
It's been around for a long time.
On
such a large scale. Yeah.
The tap dancing vaudeville show was very, which of course led to cinema. Really, to be frank, and actually, we've been working a little bit there's a vaudeville theater that's being restored in Benson, Nebraska. Benson, yeah, the Benson District of Omaha, which we've been involved in. But, you know, those types of shows, which existed, the only thing that really killed them was air conditioning.
Yeah.
Those live shows would have continued. Air conditioning came in movie theaters, and then that's what killed them. But those shows were the precursor to the modern cinema, and they, vaudeville shows were full of blackface. The tap dancing blackface dancer was the common staple of vaudeville.
You see that in Twin Time. Fred Astaire does a tap dancing blackface act in Twin Time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it didn't die out by any means.
I think, too, and I think just from being a film professor, I think there is so much that we can learn about social justice and social, you know, and parody by looking at historic cinema. And there is this kind of line that's kind of drawn that people want sound and color in movies, and we feel like anything before sound and color isn't very relevant. But you can watch great films like, you know, Birth of a Nation, and I do believe in it as a cautionary tale. I also believe in Metropolis as a cautionary tale and a monumental achievement. There's a lot we can learn from those films as long as we still consider them relevant.
Yeah.
And I think that's very, very important. We're very lucky here at Wayne State College because we have an extensive, extensive film library here on campus, which has all these relevant films in them, many of which were still on celluloid until recently, that people can watch and learn. So, I mean, I think, you know, we always talk about learning from history, but we can learn from cinema if we're willing and open-minded to those things.
And something to remember, too, when we are learning from history, don't always glorify it or romanticize it, because that's such a common flaw that we have nowadays. We want to romanticize a certain part of history or say that it was perfect then or that things were great, but they weren't. And to glorify a film like this or use it as some tool to be able to just learn from as if there's nothing, there's no problem there. That's an issue, and it's dangerous and can lead to very harmful ideologies rising up in the ranks.
I think one of the most important things about this film is that when I was a kid and we studied the Civil War, they always said, well, it was about states' rights. It wasn't about blacks or slavery. And then when you watch this film, it is absolutely an affirmation. It was about blacks and it was about slavery.
It's still a common thing today where people say that the war was not part of slavery. It was states' rights. But what were those states' rights to do? So it's just something where when we look back at history, we can't just pick the parts that we think are pretty and nice. We need to remember the whole, because there is absolutely no time in history that was perfect.
So needless to say, the film's impact on South Dakota's fledgling Klan can't be understated. Its first screening in the area was in Grand Forks, North Dakota, where it ran for a week straight to sold-out packed houses. The movie grossed $18 million nationwide and was the first film ever screened at the White House. Stepping in to harness this energy was an ex-Methodist circuit rider and revivalist lecturer, Colonel William J. Simmons of Atlanta. On Thanksgiving Eve in 1915, just before the Atlanta showing of The Birth of a Nation, Simmons gathered at Stone Mountain with some old Klan members to relaunch the Invisible Empire 2.0. When the movie played in Atlanta, the billboard announced the organization of the world's greatest secret social patriotic fraternal beneficial order. Apparently, keyword stuffing was a thing in 1915. Back in South Dakota, screenings of Birth of a Nation began in Deadwood in May of 1916. Luxuriously large ads would fill the Deadwood Pioneer Times with photos, large graphics, and glowing reviews speaking with excitement about the importance of the film. The lead Daily Caller wrote of one of these screenings, "In view of what is known of the abortive mental construction of certain censor boards, it is not surprising that this picture has been placed under a ban in some states. But in reality, there is nothing to be offered here to offend the intelligent mind. The reflection cast, and it is a dark one, is not upon the Negro, but upon the carpet-bagging Reconstructionists of the South, who exploited the Negro in carrying out their own ulterior schemes. The untouched mind of the Negro, just freed from slavery, could not be expected to grasp the significance of political relations, and there's nothing in the picture which shows him other than the dupe of unscrupulous leaders." It goes on like this, and ends with a part of the film review saying, "The picture puts the stigma on the leaders, and not upon the Negro. As someone versed in nerd culture, I can't help myself from seeing this through the lens of a modern blockbuster, complete with a rabid fan base, masked vigilantes, and even themed cosplay at the event. The lead Daily Leader describes this. An attractive item of connection to last night's performance was the costuming of 8 young ladies of Leed, who acted as ushers in gowns of the period of Reconstruction. In 1917, East River got its turn. The film screened at the Orpheum Theater in Sioux Falls. Their review is much less glowing of the film. They celebrate the story, but go to pains to note that the Klan featured in the film is not the same as the Klan rising at this time. From the Argus Leader, February 1917. When first gotten together, it is said these modern knights enrolled the best and noblest blood of the Old South. The Argus Leader goes on. They were disbanded when the hoodlums and desperate characters of the land took up the order and used it to cover their own deeds, bringing down upon the name of the Klansmen the odious reputation they have ever since borne. Essentially saying that they're okay with the Klan in principle, terrorizing black people to keep them in line, and, quote, defending white virtue, but the things got out of hand when they expanded membership. All nuance aside, the screenings at the Orpheum were packed. In Rapid City that spring, the Dreamland Theater screened Birth of a Nation to large, enthusiastic crowds. The Rapid City Journal would close its review and report by saying, "History has its skeletons, the same as any families or individuals, and they are no worse off for being brought to light and shown up, even in glaring frightfulness, to the people who have a right to know." The film had lavish screenings with large graphic ads in Sisseton and many other South Dakota towns that year. For a while after that, the excitement of the Klan simmered in South Dakota for some time, while others spoke out against the Klan. They took the secret part of the secret empire very seriously, and the records of their activities from this time are very scant, but we do know that there were a few things going on. On a cold January evening in 1918, an automobile slows and stops on a backcountry road, 8 miles outside of Ethan. A man is ejected from the car, and then the car pulls away, leaving William Remfer stranded in the middle of nowhere. With no other choice, Remfer starts walking towards Ethan. Remfer would later claim in a complaint to the governor that he knew the men who kidnapped him off the streets of Mitchell and dropped him in the country. He would call the episode a Ku Klux Klan outrage. So, on the national stage in 1919, when two public relations promoters saw the whole thing as a giant money-making scheme, they kind of seized control of leadership of the Klan. This was Edward Young Clark and Mrs. Elizabeth Tyler. Clark and Tyler agreed that a profit of 80% should be realized to consider the movement a success, and then launched their money-making venture. Imagine a pyramid scheme complete with a highly aggressive recruitment that kicks off in 1920. Clark and Tyler are highly ambitious with the Klan, and they did not want to be confined to the South. They saw the financial potential of expanding the organization into the North, especially with all those potential Northern Klans paying dues to them. To broaden the group's national appeal, first they shifted the organization's focus. Nativism was the goal with an attack on everything remotely even alien in the culture. The Klan actively opposed blacks, Jews, Roman Catholics, Asian immigrants, and immigration in general. The Klan also launched attacks on, quote, dope, bootlegging, rustling, graft, violation of the Sabbath, commercialized sex, adultery, questionable business ethics, and any other scandalous behavior as judged by the Klan vigilantes. With the Klansmen themselves exempt from this, of course. The pyramid scheme style of money generation was a wild success in the growing organization. In 1921, the National Klan had at least 100,000 members and was still growing. I can't express how shady this arrangement was, or how much this movement was driven by racist nerddom, so to describe it here is a quote from an article written by historian Charles Rambo for South Dakota History, a journal published by the State Historical Society. He describes the ridiculous arrangement of the 20s Klan as such. Its phenomenal growth can be directly attributed to the inventive nature of many Kleagles or recruiters, who were receiving at least $4 of the original $10 Kleck token, or the initiation fee required. The King Kleagle, or State Realm Leader, got $1. The Grand Goblin, who was the Regional Domain Head, got 50 cents. $2.50 went back to the Imperial Kleagles, Clark and Mrs. Tyler, in Atlanta, and $2 went to the Imperial Wizard Simmons. If a higher Kleck token or initiation fee could be garnered, then the initial recruiter could count on an even greater profit. Besides the initiation fee and regular dues, members also required to buy all regalia through the Atlanta office and received all of their publications through the Atlanta headquarters. End quote. The Grand Goblin. Anyway, Rambo says this version of the Klan makes its first appearance in July of 1921. The principal Klan salesmen appear to be from Indiana, and they began to gain support in the southeastern corner of the state around Canton and Beresford. This new version of the Klan isn't big on subtlety, and they announce their existence and their pledge to fight the state's nonpartisan league to a Sioux Falls reporter on the condition that their names be kept anonymous in the report. I don't want a rabbit hole here, but the Nonpartisan League, or the NPL, was a political organization founded in 1915 in the United States by Arthur C. Towne, a former organizer of the Socialist Party of America, on behalf of small farmers and merchants. The Nonpartisan League advocated state control of mills, grain elevators, banks, and other farm-related industries in order to reduce the power of corporate political interests in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Chicago, Illinois. That's right, kids. South Dakota and rural America used to have much more socialist tendencies. Anyway, as we said earlier, something like socialism was extremely un-American in the eyes of the new Klan, and they weren't having any of it. The next day after the Klan declared war on them in the local papers, the state manager for the Nonpartisan League, Tom Ayers, writes the governor demanding protection from the Klan for himself and the people of South Dakota. The governor is on a trip to Niagara Falls when he receives the message and tells the Associated Press that he will keep an eye on the situation. Fearing that the already growing negative press in South Dakota will hurt recruitment, the Imperial Wizard himself, William Simmons, writes to the Argus Leader on July 9th that the Klan is a reputable organization and that the talk of attacking the Nonpartisan League is false and not from him. Here's a quote from his wire. Keep in mind, he's the Grand Imperial Wizard.
The Ku Klux Klan has several authorized representatives in Sioux Falls. Reports emanating from Sioux Falls that this organization is formed to fight South Dakota farmers is a contemptible falsehood, and it is a legally chartered patriotic and fraternal organization.
The state's media and much of the public remain wary of the Klan, but the condemnation by the press is not universal. The Aberdeen News seems to think that the Nonpartisan League is alarmist and that the Klan isn't so bad. They write on July 14th, 1921, Tom Ayers prats and prattles with space in Sioux Falls press to fill. He has dug up the Ku Klux Klan bugaboo. Wonder if Tom or the people he's trying to worry have any real understanding what the Ku Klux Klan actually is and the part it played in American history. The quote is 99 years ago, but you can hear the internet comment section actually intonation. On the national front, in September, our friend Edward Clark, the, Imperial Kleagle, gets investigated for tax fraud as he apparently hasn't paid a dime in taxes on all the Klan apparel that he's been selling. Stick a pin in this side note, it's coming back up later. And so the Invisible Empire spreads across South Dakota, infecting small towns along the way. It's impossible to say how many small, silent, never-reported cases of harassment or intimidation happened that were inspired by or directly orchestrated by the Klan at this time. There is one shocking cold case in this area that stands out to many as a possible action of the Klan or its supporters. The Lee Daily Call, October 26th, 1921, in a full front page headline proclaims, Father Belknap cruelly murdered. Crime startles and shocks the entire Hills country. Well-loved priest lured to his death on the plea that his holy offices were required for a dying man, shot down by his assassin in cold blood without warning. So as we said at the top of the show and just now here, Father Belknap was lured out that night, believing that he was needed to quickly administer last rites to a dying man. Four shots would ring out through the valley of Poor Man's Gulch, where his body would be found by a nearby resident drawn by the shots. Four 45 caliber bullet holes were found in his body. The brutality of the crime shakes the Protestants and Catholics of the community of Lead to their core. The Knights of Columbus of Lead offer a $500 reward for information leading to the murderer's capture, as does the county. Authorities seek to pin the murder on a drifter named Ondario Rolando, and a massive regional search for the man began. Rolando will never be found. Many in the community are very suspicious of the Rolando theory, and think that local law enforcement don't want to find the actual killer, or killers. There are accusations back and forth between those who think that Rolando is the killer, and those who suspect a broader conspiracy of men, quote, living amongst us even now, but nothing but mistrust ever comes out of it. 1 year later, the community will mark the murder with a memorial service. To this day, and probably forever now, the case is unsolved. In 1922, in the communities around Fort Meade, a cavalry post just east of Sturgis, a rumor is started that a unit of black troops will be transferred to the post. This kicks off an explosion of Klan recruiting and activity in the Sturgis area, despite the fact that black families had already been peacefully living with their white counterparts in the community for quite some time. There were still several black individual residents who were prominent members of the community, but the fear of large numbers of colored troops with authority moving to Fort Meade apparently frightened many. The rumor comes up again around the base, again in 1923 and in 1924, but the deployment of black troops never actually happens. Not to be left out, the east side of the Sioux Empire starts seeing more openly reported Klan activity in 1923. On a warm night in June, residents of Pipestone, Minnesota are confused to see a burning cross on the horizon just north of town. About a week later, another fiery cross was reported a mile and a half southeast of Madison, South Dakota. Before it burns itself out of fuel, it is witnessed by more than 100 residents. The Argus leader speculates that the series of crosses is a signal to the order's membership to rally at some kind of activity. An atmosphere of fear that more crosses will soon burn over every town in the region spreads. The summer continues with national reports found in local newspapers of mass violence and martial law due to the Klan in Oklahoma. That's its own crazy story that won't fit into this podcast, but needless to say, the Klan was the front and center of South Dakota newspapers, even if the local Klan was not that active later in the summer of 1923. On September 20th, the Pure Capital Journal editorializes, "If you think there is no truth to the assertion that the Ku Klux Klan is a bad thing for the state and the nation, give a thought to Oklahoma, where martial law reigns supreme, and citizens live in fear of flogging and house burning without protection of the military." The Dolan Time Record concurs, and on the 21st writes, "If half the reports regarding the Klan are correct, the Oklahoma executive should have the moral support of the entire country. There is no room in the United States for an organization of this character." Despite the general public being appalled in South Dakota by the violence of Oklahoma, not everyone was so critical. A pastor in Gayville would step out as a vocal proponent of the Klan. From the September 27th, 1923 Argus Leader, "That the Ku Klux Klan is not un-American, but is serving a valuable purpose in keeping the ship of state on an even keel, was the declaration of the Reverend Methodist pastor of Gayville in his regular Sunday evening sermon. Reverend Stuck vigorously assaulted those who were criticizing the Klan without, he asserted, knowing the principles and purposes. After reviewing the things which he declared the Klan stood for, including the tenets of Christian religion, white supremacy, protection of pure womanhood, just laws and liberty, the upholding of the Constitution, the separation of church and state, free public schools, free press and free speech, sovereignty of states' rights, and limitation of foreign immigration, and local reforms, the pastor declared, 'These are the things this great organization stands for, and if anyone can see wherein they are unchristian, not loyal, or unbrotherly, or least of all un-American, then I say to you that the fraternal organizations that are found throughout the United States as well are un-American, and should be classed as such by the people of this nation. It stands for one flag, one Bible, one God. Call it un-American if you will. It is not anti-Jew, anti-Catholic, or anti-Negro. It is pro-American first, last, and always. And may God's blessing rest upon this organization if the things outlined here are true, and I have every reason to believe that they are." I'm not sure if the crowd was into it or not, but the Argus leader simply cryptically said, "His defense of the Klan has aroused much interest in the community." The sermon's response was loud and clear from the Edmonds County Democrat. "The Ku Klux Klan does not become permeated with the odor of sanctity simply because some foolish and fanatical preacher gets up to the pulpit every once in a while and makes a mockery of the religion of Jesus Christ by praising the Klan. We have fools and fanatics in every walk of life, and unfortunately the ministry is not exempt. If it were, the church would make better headway. But it is distressing that any man would profess to follow such genteel teachings as the Nazarene, whose creed was love, should take with an organization that preaches and practices hate. Any preacher who can reconcile the spirit of Christianity with the propaganda of intolerance and cruelty should find little difficulty in demonstrating that the devil is the model of a Christian gentleman. They are not alone in their repudiation of the Klan. That fall, the mayor of Sioux City denounces the organization in a fiery address. Local Klan members respond with an angry letter campaign of anonymous residents. He tells the local papers that when the Klan comes out in the open and makes themselves known, he will argue with them then. Though the Klan contends that it advocates every good American principle, its secret tactics are evidence enough to every right-thinking person that its members are moral cowards. It's clear that the Klan is not universally accepted, and may in fact be opposed by the majority of South Dakota residents. But that doesn't mean that the Klan is backing down. Far from it. You see, 1924 would be the biggest year yet for open Klan activity in South Dakota. In addition to documented cases of Klan activity, there would be less reported but still life-altering for the victims, harassment, threats, and violence that the Klan would inflict on a small scale, not often making it into the paper. Here are a couple accounts collected in 1924, collected by the previously mentioned historian Charles Rambo. For example, in that year, one suspected bootlegger in Redfield, South Dakota, received KKK attention. Blackie Smith, a coal hunter by profession, was a bootleg on the side, and was supposed to have a rather loose deal going on at home where his wife was the principal attraction, or so the Klan believed. The Klan contacted Blackie and suggested that either he leave town, or the bullwhip and tar and feather medicine would be applied. Blackie and his wife left quickly for some unknown destination. On one occasion, a lady of ill repute from Rapid City was invited to leave the Gate City. She laughed at and mocked the supposedly righteous leaders of the Pennington County Klan. She was then whisked off the street one September evening and taken to Farmingdale, where she was stripped and bathed in tar and feathers. Needless to say, she also hurriedly left Rapid City on the next train. In February, the Argus Leader reported that Klan literature and copies of the Klan's official publications were showing up all over town and being received by many residents at their home and across the city. Later that same week, the Argus Leader reported on a college freshman, Wayne Myers, who had won an oratorical contest at Sioux Falls College for his talk, The Modern Ku Klux Klan, which was highly critical of the organization. Myers received a mysterious phone call from someone claiming to speak for the Klan, who demanded that Myers stop giving the speech if he wants to win any more contests. Myers himself insists that he was not threatened with bodily harm. However, he tells the Argus Leader that he will go on giving the speech, and that after this episode, he says he was clearly on the right side of this question for opposing the modern Klan. That week, the Klan opens an official headquarters for the Sioux Falls area at 120 North Main Avenue over the Smith Hardware Store. Then on February 25th, a cross is lit in Sioux Falls that no one can miss. It's spotted around 10:30 p.m. and is 8 feet tall and 4 feet across, the finishing touches being two bright railroad flares attached to each end of the arms. It's impossible to miss as it's erected and ignited without anyone noticing, directly in the middle of the intersection at Phillips Avenue and 14th Street. This is an extremely provocative and visible spot in downtown Sioux Falls. Anyone looking down Phillips Avenue to the south would see it like a brilliant red light on the horizon. A reporter for the Rapid City Journal describes the crowd that gathered to examine it as huge with waves of people and automobiles following the light to see what was happening. That same day, reports arrived in Sioux Falls of the Klan burning crosses in St. Lawrence, South Dakota. Though authorities in Hand County dismissed them as the work of some practical joker because they are shoddily constructed, I believe they were the work of the local Klan. St. Lawrence is quite close to Wessington, where I grew up. Roy McNeil, the grandfather of my two half-siblings, would tell us kids stories about the Klan activity during this time in the Wessington Hills. And he said that he had even found a large stash of Klan robes and regalia in the old Wessington Theater's attic before the building was demolished. As Catholic kids growing up in that area, we heard stories about how the Klan had once been in the area and had been a serious threat in our grandparents' time. Father O'Neill of St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Wessington once told some parishioners that he kept a firearm in the rectory because he feared one day that the Klan might attack him or the church. I have no doubt that he had heard stories about what happened to Father Belknap in 1921. Back in Gayville, Reverend Stuck, who spoke last year about the virtue of the Klan, was asked by the board of his church to stop speaking on that topic. Instead of complying, he resigns in protest. A cross is burned in Cavour, South Dakota, where many local farmers claim that they have joined the Klan for a membership fee of $16, and that the cross was the signal for their first meeting as newly minted Klansmen. Remember, the actual fee for joining is $10, so the Klan recruiter in the area figured he could get away with fleecing these men for an extra $6 each and pocket the difference. This was a practice that was encouraged by the organization to drive more recruitment. In mid-March, Klan literature circulating in town started targeting a member of the Argus Leader editorial staff. They were particularly angry with this unnamed but pretty clearly referenced reporter for pointing out the money-making pyramid scheme-like structure of how the Klan handles members' dues. The man they were targeting outs himself with an awesomely sarcastic and defiant editorial in the Argus Leader on March 18th. The staff member is Brighton Barron, and in his editorial, "Can We Believe Anything Else from the Ku Klux Klan Hereafter?" he doubles down on his attack, pointing out that the Klan literature attacked him for not being a true Christian and called into question his character, but never actually denied that over half of their dues were going out of state, meaning that thousands of dollars were being siphoned out of the state's economy by the Klan. In an interesting episode of Living History, a surviving Civil War veteran from Sioux Falls, Colonel C.A.B. Fox, writes to the editor of the Klan's newsletter, The Fiery Cross, and shares what he sent to them with the Argus Leader on April 15th. He requests that they not hold the planned rally in Sioux Falls on Memorial Day, as that is a day set aside for South Dakota to honor dead heroes. He signs his letter with the most impressive signature lines I have ever seen. It reads, "Sincerely yours, Colonel C.A.B. Fox, past Department Commander of the Grand Army of the Republic, 216 Menlo Avenue, Sioux Falls, South Dakota." Okay, I'll admit it, I'm a giant nerd and I hear Grand Army of the Republic and I think Star Wars. Anyway, he's not the only one speaking up. Religious leaders in Brookings band together to stand against the Klan in their area. The Brookings Ministerial Association passes the following resolution the same week. "We, the members of the board of the Brookings Ministerial Association, hereby go on the record as absolutely opposed to the Ku Klux Klan organization, because we stand against all efforts to create racial, religious, and social prejudice, resulting in hatred, bitterness, and oftentimes violence. Any organization which proposes law enforcement aside from regularly constituted civil authority is un-American." In May, more anti-Klan letters fill the Argus Leader and more crosses burn, announcing the birth of new chapters in Watertown and White Lake. In June, several young men in the Deadwood area received death threats in letters signed the KKK, and to keep up the pious image they are trying to project in the Sioux Falls area, they held an outdoor Vesper service in what is now Cherry Rock Park that was attended by more than 100 members. On the evening of August 6th, 1924, one of the most dramatic events in the Klan's history in South Dakota would unfold in Sturgis. A well-attended community dance was in progress in Sturgis, while up on the hill directly to the northeast above Sturgis, the Klan burned several large crosses. Suddenly, a clattering broke out from two Browning automatic machine guns that had been mounted on the adjoining hill by several resentful cavalrymen from Fort Meade. The Klansmen leaped for cover and returned fire with handguns. Apparently, the cavalrymen only wanted to throw a scare into the Klansmen because they shortly ended the engagement and fell back from the hill. Authorities would later tell the Deadwood Pioneer Times that several deputies had been secreted along the creek in anticipation of such an attempt, and they quickly closed in on the soldiers. One might interpret that as some of the Klansmen who had returned fire with their sidearms were in fact these deputies. Just saying. Soldiers realized they were cut off and tried to ditch their weapons and blend into the street dance crowd on Main Street. The townspeople ended up catching the soldiers, who were handed over to their commanding officer the next morning for court-martial. Three soldiers were arrested: Sergeant Bell, Corporal Moore, and Bandmaster Corporal McCluskey. McCluskey had actually not been part of the attack, but had just been attending the street dance. Wrong place, wrong time. So he was released shortly after that. Aside from one very shot-up car whose occupants had taken cover behind some rocks when the shooting started, there were no injuries from the incident. It was learned in a later investigation that some of the cavalrymen wanted to bring in a light artillery piece, but had reconsidered. The men involved in firing on the Klansmen were either cashiered from the military or were quickly and quietly transferred to more peaceful pastures. The Klan is just getting started in Sturgis. On August 23rd, just weeks after the machine gun incident, the Klan held a conclave in Sturgis. An estimated 12,000 spectators parked along the hills to watch 160 new Klan members sworn in beneath three massive burning crosses. It's the first conclave ever held west of the Missouri River in the United States. In September, a much more civil battle with the Klan rages in City Hall as the mayor grants permission to the Klan to use the Sioux Falls Coliseum for a rally, but is forced by public outcry from citizens to withdraw this permission during an extremely heated council meeting. By the end of the meeting, Mayor McKinnon declared that he would keep the Klan off city property if, quote, "I have to use every member of the Sioux Falls police force to do it." In response, rumors started spreading, especially in Iowa newspapers, that the Klan was pulling members from multiple states to stage a massed march on Sioux Falls in response to the slight. The Klan literature for the time calls it a march to wake up Sioux Falls. In the Argus Leader on September 23rd, the city chief of police vows to stop any such march. He says, "We look upon with suspicion anyone wearing a mask. He may be a thief or a murderer, and instructions will be given to the officers to arrest anyone under a mask." Klan activities continued into 1925, when in March, in Hot Springs, the Klan interrupted services at a local church, according to the Argus Leader. 12 members of the Ku Klux Klan visited the Christian church where Sunday evening, in the midst of the service, tapped once on the bell at the vestibule to announce their approach, and then marched down the aisle of the pulpit, where Reverend C.B. Osgood was preaching. The leader stepped forward and made a short address commending the work of the church. He handed a small sack to the minister, and the party marched to the rear door. The sack was found to contain 25 silver dollars. Now, this is not actually an uncommon thing for the Klan to do in an area where they're trying to project legitimacy. In several other areas of the country, the Klan had succeeded in gaining the support of these ministers and in recruiting their talents against the local Catholic, Jewish, or foreign elements. Fortunately, the local ministerial association in that area had already made their peace with the Catholics in Sturgis. Father Columban Bergenzer, the popular and respected rector of St. Martin's Academy since 1903, had worked very closely with the Presbyterian minister C.D. Erskine and several others of prominence in the community, some who were active Klansmen, to keep a lid on the religious tension and to keep the bad situation from getting worse. On more than one occasion, the Klan was known to have paraded in full regalia up to Reverend Erskine's pulpit to present the purse of persuasion, which is what this thing was called, $30 to $40 to the congregation. This sort of internal give and take left religious elements shaken and suspicious. The Catholics, for instance, were said to be organizing and arming to protect themselves. Fortunately, the wide-scale violence that both sides prepared for never came to fruition. The peak Klan event in South Dakota would happen that summer, when it was announced that the National Ku Klux Klan Conclave would be held in Belfouche, South Dakota that summer on the 4th of July. It was billed to be the largest Klan gathering in a single place in history. Some early reports estimated that as many as 100,000 Klansmen would travel across the country to be there. The National Conclave in Texas the previous year had drawn about 75,000 people. At the time of the event, the Klan itself estimated membership nationally at 11 million in the United States and 25,000 in South Dakota, with 11,000 of those in the Black Hills area. On May 17th, 1925, the Klan interrupted Belfouche church services to present purses of persuasion to the local Protestant churches as part of laying the groundwork for this upcoming convention. Some of the stats on the preparations for this gathering, just to give you a perspective, 10,000 new Klan robes were ordered, 3,000 candles were ordered, 7 brass bands, the state drum corps, 8 string quartets, and an unknown number of smaller musical organizations were brought in by train. The fireworks budget was $3,000, which, adjusted for inflation, would make that $44,000 in July 2020 money. 400 additional special policemen were sworn in for security. Parking for 30,000 cars was prepared. Railroad companies across the United States provided special Klan rates for travelers to attend the rally. The Deadwood Pioneer Times estimates that this will be the largest gathering of people in the history of South Dakota up to that date. As you may have guessed by now, the event did not live up to the hype. Though the weather was perfect and everyone who attended agreed that it was a great Klan event, if there's such a thing, attendance was estimated to be closer to 22,000 people. There were smaller rallies in the state that summer, and it was truly the summer of the Klan in South Dakota for all of the dances, social events, and parades and rallies that the group held. That fall, a group of young college students showed their potential strength at the Spearfish Normal School. A local fraternity of the KKK had been formed earlier, and by 1925 had gained a substantial membership. Docker Woodburn, an ordained minister and then president of the Normal School, held chapel at 10 o'clock every morning. And at one of these sessions, he delivered a provocative sermon against the Ku Klux Klan. A number of the young men at the fraternity took exception to his comments and went out that night to Dr. Woodburn's garage, borrowed gasoline from his own car, and set a flaming cross in his front yard. Only the fast thinking on the part of his neighbors kept his house from burning down. Dr. Woodburn delivered no more anti-Klan speeches after that, at least not in public. In 1926, the Klan began running large ads in South Dakota newspapers as part of a new tactic to gain recruits and polish their image in the community. These ads spoke nothing about what they were against or the vigilante actions, but talked about their charity work and even called the Klan a religious organization that is not a church but a friend to all true Protestant churches. Way fewer large gatherings of the Klan happened in South Dakota than happened in 1925, but in Sioux City they still managed to hold a large parade. The event had almost not been allowed to proceed, but then at the last minute Klan leadership made an agreement with the city they would parade without their masks, and that convinced city authorities to allow the march to move forward. One parade of note occurred in downtown Sioux Falls in late August of that year to celebrate the Tri-State Conclave. A crowd estimated at 10,000 watched as nearly 500 Klansmen paraded back and forth through downtown Sioux Falls. All participants were required to be unmasked. The Argus Leader reports that a large police presence kept everything calm and kept traffic flowing, and the whole thing went off without a disturbance. A quarter-page ad in the Rapid City Journal in October would unknowingly serve as the death rattle for the Klan, both as a large national presence, and it would also mark the end of the largest Klan open activities in South Dakota. 1927 was a very bad year for the Klan nationally. Internally, it was a wreck. Long story short, Hiram Evans, this guy in Texas, was now in full revolt against Joseph Simmons, who was now the Grand Wizard of the Atlanta chapter, and many splinter clans had begun to form for no other reason than the prospect of making money. The Imperial Kleagles we mentioned earlier, our marketing experts Clark and Tyler, were under state indictment for disorderly conduct and adultery. They were also charged by their rivals within the Klan for appropriating substantial sums of the national treasury for their own private use. Shocker. The general public was being daily entertained by stories of Klan violence, beatings, and lynchings directed against an ever-growing number of critics who saw the Klan as a lawless threat to themselves, their families, and their dreams of what America should be. The movement had become stale and seemed to have run out of relevant or significant issues by 1927. There was still, of course, the election of 1928, which would kindle a very, very dying ember of this, but was not enough to revitalize the Klan in South Dakota. Historian Charles Rambo, who we mentioned earlier, also says that the extinction of local Klans could also be attributed to the fact that the KKK just plain scared many people. Enough threats were issued and enough emotion aroused that many were fearful that the continued Klan activity would lead to disastrous consequences. Anti-Klan opposition was growing, the Catholics were organizing for a possible showdown, and any little slip-up could erupt into a regrettable situation. There was also probably an economic factor here. The Klan was hurting business. Many people who were not sold on the purposes of the Klan remained disassociated by staying away from businesses that had Klan support or hired Klan employees. It was also probable that the general economic recession, which was already being keenly felt in this area and would result in the national economic collapse of 1929, had diverted local attention from the supposed threat of Catholic, Jewish, or alien minorities. As the Klan declined, the North and South Dakota organizations were merged with the Minnesota Clavern. The tri-state realm was perpetuated for a time after 1927 by the inevitable diehards. But by the mid-1930s, the North Central Klan was dead. Just a bunch of costumes in an attic found by men who would tell their grandchildren about finding strange things from a time when an invisible empire was a force to be reckoned with in the Sioux Empire. So that's it. The Klan's gone forever. Well, not exactly. The brand is pretty much ruined in South Dakota at this point, but the legacy of the Klan continues into modern times. There was an infamous episode where students at Dakota Wesleyan burned a cross in 1961, but that does generally kind of fall into the realm of young hoodlums, more, you know, trying to make trouble than it was actual, like, an organization. Every once in a while, Klan flyers with bags of candy show up on playgrounds or on people's doors, but as far as an open organization operating like it did in the 1920s, I don't think we'll see its like again in South Dakota. So is the story over? Well, the robes and the stupid names like Grand Goblin are gone, but the original causes of the Klan still exist today, and in fact, I mean, we're kind of in a second Gilded Age, so at this point, some of them perhaps seem even stronger than when the Klan was formed so long ago. Discrimination against those who are different from oneself is evidence that inequality is still a battle being fought in South Dakota. In fact, you could argue many of them thrive in the age of the internet. So today we're going to finish this episode with an interview with Lori Miller. She's the director of research and a board member for South Dakota Voices for Peace and South Dakota Voices for Justice. She's been actively tracking anti-immigrant and anti-Islam groups and events and legislation in South Dakota for more than 3 years. I think this conversation will help give us some perspective on how, while the Klan may be gone in name, a lot of its ideas remain very modern and very relevant to our current age.
As I say, I've been tracking hate groups or anti-immigrant, anti-Islam groups in the state for over 3 years now. And they are very active.
Do you think the organization itself of the Ku Klux Klan, is that something that you still see operating in South Dakota at all?
We don't see necessarily what people would call a Klan rally like they had in the past. What we have seen, though, is more contemporary hate groups that have picked up where the Klan started and are working it into our circumstances today. One classic example, the KKK does have some activity in the state because over the last 2.5-3 years, on the eastern side of the state mostly, and on college campuses, we're seeing the Klan recruitment flyers, and those are actually put out by Identity Europa. They're the group that is actively spreading them, but of course it goes back to the Klan, right? Because they're saying join the KKK through us, basically.
Kind of shell organizations or ones that are kind of like everything but the name kind of kicking around.
Exactly. The anti-racist, or the racist and anti-immigrant ideas that the Klan was based in continue today through these other groups. And one of the things that I think has made these other groups be able to attract an audience, reach a lot of people, is through social media. I think we have greatly underestimated the power that social media gives modern day hate groups. We have a good example with what happened in Sioux Falls when they were saying that there was a rumor going around that Antifa was sending busloads of protesters from Fargo to Sioux Falls. And that rumor was put around all over the country that Antifa was bringing busloads of people into whatever city they were choosing in that state. I have family in Washington State, they saw the same thing for one of their towns. And then, of course, Sioux Falls had theirs, and then they said they were coming to Rapid, and that never happened. Unfortunately, in Sioux Falls, though, it was an elected official that sounded the alarm based on the rumors on social media. And then that went to the police chief, and, you know, they were telling downtown shops and everybody to board up your windows, bring in anything that could be thrown. And then ultimately, the National Guard was invited to Sioux Falls to combat this. And there was some issues that happened at the Empire Mall area. But the thing is it wasn't busloads of people from Fargo. The people that were involved in what happened in Sioux Falls that day were local young people, you know, like high school age. But the fact is that our elected officials saw this rumor and completely, totally overreacted on it and used essentially military, National Guard, against our citizens based on ultimately what turned out to be nothing but rumors. armor. And we really have to be cognizant of why that happened, how it happened, and what are we going to do to make sure it doesn't happen again. You know, the Sioux Falls thing was relatively small, but there's not much difference in the National Guard coming to the mall area of Sioux Falls than what President Trump did to the people in Lafayette Park so he could get his photo in front of the church. What are we going to do? These hate groups online are able to alarm our elected leaders, and they feel that it's worthwhile to use the National Guard against our citizens. We need to be aware of this. We need people to know that you have to look up the information, because they're using social media to cause lots of trouble. And as it turns out, those rumors about the busloads of rioters was put out by Identity Europa.
Do you think that an organization using the brand and the name Ku Klux Klan will ever meaningfully operate in South Dakota again at the scale that it did the last century?
I think the KKK name is probably, as you said, very tarnished, but the groups are, they all have that same core idea, right? That brown people and immigrants that come to this country are not worthy of the rights that the rest of us in this country have, that brown people that are another religion, specifically Muslim, are a threat to our way of life. That's no different than what the KKK was saying. In that name, it may not be real active, but that's okay, because there's lots of groups to pick up where they left off.
What are some hate groups that you track that you think that listeners should be aware of operating in South Dakota?
Americans First Task Force of Aberdeen. It's an online Facebook page type group. If you go to their Facebook page, it's awful. Awful things are said, and false information is propagated on this site and shared, and it's very dehumanizing. It's made to incite fear. Because, I mean, in South Dakota, we know that we don't necessarily have a lot of diversity in this state, being, what, 92% Caucasian, I believe? So they use these false stories to talk about immigrants in a way that causes fear. One of the groups, another one, I don't know how active they are now, but Act for America, that is hugely an anti-Islam, anti-immigrant organization that operates nationwide. I'm trying to think. We did have a chapter here in South Dakota. I know in the last year, some of the hate network that I have been tracking for 3 years seems to have disbanded a bit. There's no longer the connection between key players that there used to be, but I'm sure they will be coming back soon. And there's still the social media aspect where all this information can be sent out, whether it's factual or made up.
Organized discrimination in the state that's like an organization like the ones we just talked about or the Klan? Or do you think that most of the discrimination that immigrants in South Dakota face is more on a small personal scale? Which of those do you think is more of the bigger issue in day-to-day life?
Both of them, honestly. The hate network in South Dakota that I have tracked and outlined for 3 years, one of the problems is it starts at the very top with Donald Trump. When he came down the escalator saying that Mexicans were rapists, murderers, all that kind of stuff, he really opened the door for the white nationalists to come out of the woodwork, per se. So then we have governors like Kristi Noem, who is a huge Trump supporter and follows his agenda to the extent that she can and incorporate some of those policies here in South Dakota. She makes comments like about COVID outbreak at Smithfield there in Sioux Falls, that those people didn't get sick at work. It's because their culture has them living in multi-generational homes. We have state legislators who have consistently voted to discourage immigration of any kind. They want to support the ICE raids. They support anti-immigrant, anti-Islam bills like Sharia law bills. And then you have your local political groups, you know, such as county Republican parties. They are part of sponsoring these speakers that come into the state. And so the people are exposed to what people of the anti-immigrant, anti-Islam network are spreading. And of course, they get paid to do this. They're also making money in the process. And then we even have church pastors in the state that are part of this group. So what it boils down to is that all of the basic authority figures that people are looking at are giving them the same false information, which is reaffirming their ideas of racism and anti-immigrant. When the organized groups come in with their message, be it Identity Europa, Act for America, any number of those types of groups, when they come in with that message that, you know, from an organized hate group, that just goes again to reaffirm what they're hearing from their political leaders, from the president on down.
The reason that you don't see, like, straight up out in the open kind of Klan-like activity in modern times is that because we've institutionalized a lot of discrimination within our government and organizations and different institutions that kind of carry that out on behalf of those groups, so those, you know, vigilante kind of groups aren't necessary anymore. Do you think that's true? And if, just to clarify, kind of an example of that is the speaker I was listening to that was talking about this was talking about comparing modern policing in some regions to, you know, like slave patrols and things like that, where if a police department has like institutional discrimination where they tend to harass like a minority in an area, you know, that kind of fills the role that these hate organizations that were not government sanctioned carried out past. Do you think there's truth to that? That's part of why, is that if anything, the Klan or like its ideas have been institutionalized?
Most definitely. The very roots of our country are based on racist ideas. And those racist ideas have been incorporated into our laws, our custom, our national policies from the inception of this country. And people like to gloss over it. The history that is taught to our children in public schools is very much whitewashed. We talk about all the good things we did, and we just kind of barely glaze over the bad stuff and move on to the next thing. And that's one of the problems that within our society today is that we have yet to acknowledge the things that we have done to people of color, to indigenous people, to black people. Until we can acknowledge it and identify where these issues are within our systems, we can't fix them. So Black Lives Matter, their whole movement about police departments and policing, that goes back to policy, not necessarily individual officers, but the overall policy. A couple of really interesting books to help understand better the racism that is inherent in our society structurally is a book by Ibram Kendi called Stamped from the Beginning. And then another one, I cannot think of the author's name at the moment, but it's called The Color of Law, The History of Government Segregation in the United States. They both explain very well the policies. I think most people have heard of things like redlining, where banks won't provide loans for black people to purchase homes. That's a systemic issue. There's so many examples, it's hard to pick just one or two. That is pervasive throughout the United States. At some point it changed where, you know, you didn't see things actively, after 1965 and the whole civil rights movement, those things were no longer openly put on paperwork, but there were workarounds for it all along. And things like homeowners association, because they're not a government body, they're a private organization by the neighborhood, and they were able to put in things. I know another one was that a black person cannot rent, purchase, or otherwise live in a home in this particular neighborhood unless they were there as like a nanny or a housekeeper, that kind of thing. But they couldn't be the homeowner or the renter, and we still have things like that. They show up on the paperwork and they say, oh, but nobody pays any attention to that. Other issues come in as well. The idea of things like apartments, duplexes, that kind of thing. A lot of areas when they're being developed, it is determined that, nope, we can't have any apartments here, because they think that apartments are going to attract black people or other people of color that are going to bring down the home values. That's the excuse that they give. So yes, it's very much rampant through all of our policies. Another good book for people who are interested in understanding more about this is also by Ibram Kendi called How to Be an Anti-Racist. And he explains really well the racist ideas and the racist policies that are inherent in our government and society.
Yeah, that book is getting a lot of press right now. That it makes a lot of interesting arguments, like the idea of, I have always personally thought of racism as a status. You know, it's like a person is racist or a person is not racist. And something I found fascinating in that book was the concept of the, it's like, well, everyone is kind of implicitly or, subconsciously racist, but there's racist actions, and it's not a thing where it's like, okay, you have green status now, so now you can do no wrong, or you have red status and you can do no right, kind of the idea that it's much more dynamic and complex. So I found that book very interesting. I would recommend that too.
Also, another book I read right after I read How to Be an Anti-Racist that was interesting is White Fragility. And it talks about what you were just saying about people being able to separate being a racist from the entire state of being to having racist ideas or having been socialized in a community or a country that is rampant with racism predisposes most of us to have a certain amount of it. And what I would say with both these books is for anybody who wants to understand better the racist issues, racism in our society, and the barriers to overcoming it, those two books, if you read them with an open mind and an open heart, it will help you understand more what we've done as a society and the effect that it has on all of us, be we a black person or a white person. Those are very good books to read on that front. You were talking about the racist idea that, you know, the idea you're either wholly a racist or you have some racist ideas and some not. A perfect example that is going on right now. In 2014, Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri. And we, you know, there was huge riots. There was huge backlash going on with that. And then here in the end of May, we have George Floyd, who was murdered by a police officer. We all got to see the video of exactly how that happened. And there have been protests all across the country. There, unfortunately, some did turn into riots. But the difference is, do you know what the single most important difference is between Ferguson riots and the ones we've seen about George Floyd?
What's that?
It is that white people are involved. White people finally woke up and said, oh my goodness, we can't have this. This is wrong. Those cops just blatantly murdered him. So when you look at the protests that have been going on since George Floyd's murder, you see white people, Asian people, Middle Eastern people, black people, it's everybody as a whole that are going enough. The minority groups can't do it on their own, right? They need the backup of the rest of us. And that means not just saying, oh, I think that was wrong. No, that means getting out in the streets and voicing your opinion. It means contacting your local legislators and saying, hey, we need to do something here. In looking at the peaceful protest and the riots surrounding the George Floyd murder and protests, there have been several different ways that far-right white nationalist groups have been connected to either some of the looting, arson, or adding to infiltrating the Black Lives Matter movement by putting up these fake accounts with basically like the busloads of people coming. But like I know in Minneapolis, one of the people arrested for setting the police department on fire was a white man suspected to be part of a white nationalist organization. So what they're doing is they're trying to infiltrate these various movements and make them look bad, make them look violent. Like all the talk of Antifa, right? You always hear them saying, oh, Antifa's going to do this, Antifa's going to do that. Antifa is completely fictional organization created by white nationalists. People may be anti-fascist, but there is not a group that is organized in any significant fashion across the country that is what they call Antifa. I'm not sure if it was November of 2017 or November of 2018, but I want to say it was 2017 that they were talking about this big nationwide movement that Antifa was going to have on November 4th. And the rumors about it were so bad here in Rapid City that I, as a leader of Rapid City Indivisible, had to call the police department representative that I work with on a regular basis to explain to her that I don't know anything about this. If anything does happen, Indivisible Rapid City is not involved. And it was all a hoax put out by people trying to stir up trouble. And that's just like the event that happened in Sioux Falls after the very peaceful and large, well-organized event mourning the murder of George Floyd. And we had the incident at the Empire Mall. But those were local people, local kids, really. But so where they got their ideas from, was it that there was going to be this busload and they could go blend in? I don't know. But that's the idea, is to make the peaceful protests and the peaceful organizations or movements look violent and lawless.
Someone in the media, I'm trying to remember who, someone prominent said something about, you know, this is a catalyst moment, and that one way or another, this is, we won't go back to business as usual after George Floyd and after everything that's happened with that. Because something is snapped or broken or shifted, and there's a new landscape from it.
Oh, right. A lot of people woke up to the atrocities. And another good example that is recent, in the global perspective of history recent, the Charlottesville protest that was put on by white nationalists. And then we had the counter-protesters that were saying, hey, this is not okay, this is not the America we want to live in. And then, of course, the woman was killed by the gentleman who drove his car into the crowd. They had a huge attendance there in Charlottesville. A couple weeks later, they had a thing planned in Boston. And Boston was like, oh, no, we're not having that. And they said, I think it was like 300 people that were part of the white supremacy group. They had 30,000 counter-protesters at that event. The event didn't happen because that small group of white supremacists were escorted out of the area with police. And that was the entire population, well, not the entire, but a large segment of the population of Boston saying, no, we're not having it. That's what it takes. I know with our hate network here in South Dakota, in 2017, there were almost 30 events that were anti-immigrant or anti-Islam. And then mid-2017, there started to be protests about these speakers that were coming in to spread the anti-immigrant, anti-Islam agendas. So then in 2018, the level dropped to, I want to say, less than 20. This year, there hasn't been one. Because most of these groups, when they are publicly called out for their activities, they don't like it. They don't like it being advertised what they're spreading, because I think part of them knows it is wrong.
Yeah. That's something I really took away from doing this history, this deep dive, was one, that the Klan, when they rose up in the 20s in South Dakota, were not unopposed. There were a lot of people who sounded remarkably modern in the newspaper speaking out against the Klan. There's a lot of voices, even in that time, who are courageously standing up and saying, no, this is discriminatory. There's lots of church leaders who are speaking out and saying, you know, this organization claims to be Christian, but you know, it's the antithesis of Christianity that they speak out against, you know, the people, foreigners in our land and stuff like that. And, there's always been,
That makes me think of the saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, nothing new under the sun, that kind of stuff.
Because the basic ideas are no different today than they were in 1920.
Yeah.
And they were in the 1800s, right? It's all the same basic idea. I'm white, I'm better than you. So, I mean, that's a basic idea right there. And we do have churches today that are definitely speaking out about the discrimination and the racism in this country. But I also think, you were saying a few minutes ago about the person on TV saying that something broke finally.
Yeah.
Right? And I think we're kind of seeing that in some of the Christian churches as well. Obviously, the Christian churches as a whole is huge, right? Because there are so many different denominations in Christianity. And we're seeing some who are propagating the anti-immigrant, anti-Islam, racist agenda. We have two here in Rapid City, for sure, and we have one in Sioux Falls, for sure. But then, of course, we have all these other churches that are not a part of that, so I think there's kind of a division. Another example would be the Methodist Church and their huge split on LGBTQ issues. Part of that church organization wants to be supportive and welcoming and inclusive. The other part is absolutely adamant that they don't want anything to do with LGBTQ people. So I think we're seeing it across many lines within our society. And I'm hoping that because so many people have woken up to this, so many white people, so many Christians, that hopefully now we can be able to move forward with substantial change. But we have to keep the conversation going. We have a short attention span as a nation.
That is one of the things I like about podcasting, is that you get to do, it's one of the few mediums left where it's like a deep dive as possible. And kind of related to that, I'm going to segue into another question for you. Given that, I'm guessing that a lot of times when you speak to media, I saw in the news there where you got a few sound bites here or a few sound bites there or just a quote in the newspaper. If there's anything that you'd ever want to express more deep dive here, this is a podcast, so I don't have a time constraint, or if there's something more in depth you've never gotten to talk about on some of those that you just wanted to mention, or like a topic that you feel like not enough people are knowing about related to this, feel free to express that if you've got anything like that in mind.
I do. Thank you. One thing would be re-educate yourself on our history by reading some of the books that we've talked about, by seeking out different information from different sources about the racist basis that our country was founded on and what we have done over the centuries to black people and to other people of color or immigrants. I think most of us don't have a real strong handle on that part of our history. And I include myself in that, most definitely. So I think that is important to really understand how we got to where we are and what we need to change to make it better. And then the other thing is don't trust a limited scope of resources, because not all leaders in our society have good intentions, or they don't have necessarily the same personal moral code or ethical judgment that you may have, anybody else may have. It's important to basically question authority. Just because they're your pastor or leader of the local political party doesn't mean that everything they say is the truth. I'm not saying they all lie, don't get me wrong. But, you know, learn for yourself and come to your own conclusion. Don't let somebody else feed it to you. The other thing is try to learn about different people. For example, like up in Aberdeen, there's the American First Task Force of Aberdeen that is hugely anti-immigrant. Their Facebook page is horrible for the propaganda that they spread. Try to learn more about the people that they are identifying in such a negative way, because very rarely is one source unbiased one way or the other. So look for that additional information. And most importantly, just love for each other. I mean, you know, that's not hard. And if you're a Christian, that's what it's supposed to be about, right? If you're not, still love everybody. We all basically want the same thing. And because we acknowledge that this person is just as much of a human as I am, doesn't mean I'm less. It just means we're equal.
Once again, that was our interview with Lori Miller, the Director of Research and a board member for South Dakota Voices for Peace and South Dakota Voices for Justice. If you have a small organization, like a church group or something like that, that would like a presentation about the topics that Lori discussed today, she has informed me that she does give group speeches and presentations on this topic, and that you can reach her at an email that I'll provide in the show description. Once again, I just want to say thank you very much for listening. I really hope you guys are liking the new show format. If you want to support the show, one of the best ways you can do it is to leave a 5-star review on iTunes or leave a review on any of the other platforms that offer that feature. If you really want to help us out, it's an amazing help for some people that have made one-time donations or have made Patreon donation. You can do all that at our website, thesueempirepodcast.com, which has links to all of these different giving sites. I really appreciate you listening. I hope you're learning a lot. I know I am learning a lot through this experience. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next time.